Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Egypt's in disarray. Cairo is burning. Microsoft gets no respect from investors, and Ford hits a wall. All this and lots more, and our special guest, Peter Schiff from Euro Pacific Capital, all on episode number 197 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, thanks for joining me. This is Andrew Horowitz, and I'm your host here over at the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Lots to talk about. There is no shortage of information, no shortage of news flow, no shortage of outbreaks of craziness throughout the world. And we're going to talk about that and get into that and see how that affects our investments and what that really means for the bigger picture. We also have some follow-up from last week. We got some great emails from you. Thank you so much for your comments on the discussion we had on emerging markets. And of course, we talked about that episode number 200 is going to be the listener call-in show. We got plenty of calls, plenty of emails, but I want to make sure that everybody gets an opportunity to participate. So do me a favor, send an email to AskAndrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com and just put your name, your phone number, and your basic topic that you want to talk about, and we'll arrange a time to actually get you recorded on the show. Just send it to AskAndrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Whatever the question may be, there's nothing too small. There's nothing insignificant. We'll cover it all for you, and hopefully we'll at least get you an answer, if not push you in the right direction to what you may want to look at, look for, and who to talk to. So don't be shy. I thought what we'd do today, though, before we get into the discussion of just, you know, all the things that are happening and some of the earnings issues, I thought we'd get right to our guest, Peter Schiff. He is an accomplished author. He is also head of Euro Pacific Capital, as well as the Peter Schiff Show. But I thought because of what has gone on in the world, it would be just a really perfect person to bring on and talk about what's going on throughout the world, what's going on with gold, what we should be looking for, China with all the things that they're doing and the potential bubble or not. So let's get that up in the beginning of the show, and then the back end we'll talk about some things that I have to bring you. Also, how to get up-to-the-minute, absolutely timely news on Egypt. We put together something for you. We'll talk about that. So let's get right to our guest, Peter Schiff. Peter, how are you? It's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a while. I've been good. And, you know, the Peter Schiff Show can be heard on schiffradio.com for people who want to listen to it. It's every day, Monday through Friday, from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern time.
Wow, that's a lot of commitment. So I want to talk to you about a lot of things that are going on, because obviously, you know, I've seen you talk. I've heard your work. I've read it as well. And, of course, we all know that you're very bullish on gold. But let's put that aside for 1 second, because I want to talk about this whole idea that you brought up a number of years ago that didn't work out, but then it kind of came back to, I think, being so. Which, do you still work with this whole decoupling idea? Where is that going? And do you think the future still holds that as a basis?
Well, absolutely. I mean, my theory has been that if you want to use a train as an analogy, the U.S. economy is not the engine, but the caboose. And if the caboose is decoupled from the train, it moves faster, not slower. I think the world has been dragging the dead weight of the U.S. economy, in that we are consuming more than we are producing. We are borrowing more than we are saving. And so we are living beyond our means. And the only reason that's possible is because everybody else is living beneath their means. In particular, the emerging markets, countries like China, where the currency has been pegged to the dollar, and therefore their currency has been artificially suppressed, and their purchasing power is temporarily being transferred to Americans. And I believe that as they unwind this, those economies will prosper, because they will begin to consume their own production rather than exporting it to us in exchange for paper.
So one of the things that I thought was interesting, and I think that people really don't have a handle on, and I tried the other day to actually come up with just a number. So in China, back a couple of years back, there was that giant stimulus plan. I think it was $587 billion equivalent. And we did the $700 plus billion, aside from all the other things. I'm just talking about that stimulus, you know, if you can kind of nail one. And I was thinking, wow, the per capita income in the United States is X, and the per capita income on average in China is X divided by what, 10, 12?
Something like that.
So that $500 billion of stimulus that China did was actually more equivalent to, I don't know, $4 or $5 trillion. Do you agree with that?
Well, first of all, I don't think what they did was stimulus. I think they call it economic stimulus. It would have been better for the economy had the Chinese government simply stopped buying treasuries and allowed the RMB to rise in value. That would have been far more stimulative than what they did. But the main difference between the Chinese, quote-unquote, stimulus and ours is that we borrowed the money for our stimulus. They had the money.
Right.
They didn't borrow anything. And so our stimulus was actually a sedative. We destroyed our economy because we had to go into debt to spend the stimulus money, and the act of increasing the debt was a bigger drag on the economy, a bigger depressant than people spending the money. So at least in China, they didn't have that problem.
Right. So check this out. I think you'll like this. I just wrote a paper. I don't know when it was. It was, last week, our quarterly commentary. And I talked about what happened with the $600 billion QE2. So I think you may have thought of this, but maybe you haven't. I want to throw this by you. So the idea that Bernanke came out with when he came out with the $600 billion stimulus, or whatever you want to call it, the QE2, was that, this is going to be good because we're going to reduce the rates down so people could buy their mortgages. We're going to do better for unemployment, et cetera, et cetera. That's the political line that he gave, right? Well, what ended up happening was something much different. So here's my theory. This is a whole play on misdirection, just like one of the great illusionists, whereas you kind of like put this whole thing and make everybody think it's something that sounds good. But really what ended up happening was by him doing this, he pressed on the center part of the yield curve, bulged the end, thus giving a much greater incline to the whole yield curve, right? Therefore, who does that benefit? The banks. So this whole scam was all about funding more money into the banks. What do you think?
Well, this is not what I actually think that the Fed, was surprised because their actions backfired. I believe that when they said their goal of QE2 was to reduce long-term interest rates, I believe that was the goal. That's what they set out to do. They wanted to try to reflate the stock market, the housing market. They were looking to produce wealth effects. They stated that was their goal. So that's what they wanted to do. The fact of the matter is they failed miserably because the exact opposite of what they wanted to happen happened. And it's what I said was going to happen. When the Fed prints money to buy bonds, they make bonds less valuable, not more valuable. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what happened. And then the Fed quickly had to spin it as if they were a success. I mean, they made lemons out of lemonade, and they're saying that the QE2 is working so great that we skipped the low interest rates and went directly to the economic growth, and they're now trying to say that interest rates are rising because QE2 works so well. I mean, talk about a chutzpah.
Yeah, exactly. At the very least. All right, I think they, my theory is that they were smarter than everybody, and they tried to do something to help the banks, but either way, what they tried to do didn't necessarily work in terms of the individual.
Well, I definitely will reject out of hand that they're smarter than anybody. I don't know how smart the people are.
Outfoxed it. So let's go to Japan for a second, because Japan was recently downgraded this week, where their sovereign debt rating by S&P was down to, AA-, and there was a commentary, which I think is right in line with what I would say is a Peter Schiff focus, is that the S&P said that they are now closer, or there's a shorter time period, to when the U.S. sovereign debt may be downgraded, considering all the things that are going on. Did you see that?
Well, I didn't see it, but it certainly makes sense. I mean, if they're going to downgrade Japan, we owe Japan $1 trillion. The Japanese government has $1 trillion in treasury, so I don't see how Japan could possibly default without first cashing in that trillion in treasuries that we owe them. And where are we going to get that money? So if they think Japan's in trouble, they got to downgrade the U.S. debt because we're going to go broke before them because we owe them. It's not the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing with China. China's got a lower credit rate than the U.S., even though the Chinese basically has no debt. I mean, China has almost $3 trillion in reserves. So China hardly has any debt. They can easily pay it back. We have a ton of debt. It's impossible to pay it back. Yet S&P thinks that we're a better credit risk than China. I mean, go figure.
Yeah. So what about China, though? I know you've been very active in that area. You really liked it. Stock market there has not been doing well since they started tightening. Is that a concern of yours, or is it a temporary kind of just
I'm not concerned. I think that the Chinese stocks are in long-term bull markets, and I think the valuations are good. And so I want to be a buyer long-term. I'm not a short-term trader. I don't advise any of my clients to speculate in the short run. And so short-term weakness is nothing that concerns me, and my clients aren't utilizing leverage. Right. So they're not getting margin calls if Chinese stocks go down. They're paying good dividends, and so that gives you immediate cash flow. So I look at it as opportunities, because as clients send new money in, they have an opportunity to buy at lower prices.
And the big thing about what you do, so here's what I want to make sure that people understand, is that, you know, a lot of people talk about buying a Chinese stock, and I'll give an example, like a Baidu. So you go onto the exchange and you buy Baidu, but you have such a negative feeling towards the U.S. dollar and what the eventual issue is going to be that doing that would go against. So what you do is you actually buy on the exchange of whatever, the Shanghai exchange or whatever exchange you're going to trade on of the foreign country, right?
Well, I do that, but the exchange really doesn't have an effect because the currency is going to wash, you know, come out in the wash, because it's ultimately where the earnings are generated. But the thing is, most of the domestically focused Chinese companies aren't trading in the U.S. There are some now, and there are some Chinese stocks trading here that we're able to buy, but the vast majority are outside. They trade in, you get a lot more exposure to China if you're trading in Hong Kong than in the U.S. market. And I want to buy the Chinese companies that are benefiting from the decoupling, that are benefiting from the greater purchasing power from a growing Chinese middle class. That's what I want. So I don't want to be a big investor of the companies that are dependent on Americans as their consumer, because I think Americans are broke. We're loaded up with debt. We're in a lot of trouble. I'd rather have my customers have a lot of savings, have a brighter prospect. And so we're focusing on that Chinese domestic consumer.
So I couldn't not talk about gold with Peter Schiff. Here's the deal. So more recently, gold kind of has the connotation of, okay, inflation protection, problem if something happens in the world, all sorts. And gold seemed to have been going up regardless of maybe some of the indications that you would expect it to be. A lot of the world harmony got a lot better, from an outward stance. And then all of a sudden, again, last week we saw the whole eruption in Egypt, and then all of a sudden gold really started moving hard, which I would say would be that's a natural move for gold, just in that one discussion. So I know you're a long-term gold bull. I mean, where are we going here? Was that that 10% or that 8% drop in gold recently just a quick respite?
Well, I think we're going a lot higher in gold. I mean, gold is in a bull market for 10 years for a reason, and that reason is inflation. It's because central banks around the world, not just the Federal Reserve, but all central banks are too loose. They're creating too much money. Interest rates are too low. And so money loses value. You need a storehouse of purchasing power, and that's gold. Meanwhile, there's very few alternatives now to gold when you have currencies with such low yields. And so I think that's happening. We have had a correction in the price of gold since gold put in its highs. I think it was late last year, early this year, when gold peaked out. I think, the peak was in December, and it tried to retest that peak in late December, December 31st, couldn't do it. And so we've had a pullback. Whether that pullback has come to an end or not is always a guessing game, but I don't think there's much more left in the correction. If you look back over the 10 years of this bull market, I think with the exception of 2008, the precious metals have made their lows in either January or February for the year. So I think that's this seasonally is when you get the weakness. And we certainly, we had, three attempts to move through 1,400, one two in November, one in November and two in December. When we couldn't move above, I think you got some profit taking. I guess some of the weaker money is getting nervous and getting out. But, we got a triple top around 1,400, and triple tops are made to be broken, and I'm sure we will break that triple top sometime soon.
I hear you. Peter Schiff, again, you could find him at Euro Pacific Capital. Also, the Peter Schiff Show available. Just go to his website or just Google him, whatever, and you could check it out on iTunes as well. It's the Peter Schiff Show that comes on daily through iTunes and your podcast. You can download it. Hey, thanks for joining me. We'll talk soon, okay?
All right, thanks for having me. Good luck.
All right, great stuff. Thanks, Peter. the whole idea of gold breaking through that triple top, you know, is that going to happen? Is it not going to happen? I think that we have to really consider that gold traditionally is run up, of course, due to what? Inflation, problems around the world, currency concerns. And so we have a lot of that brewing. We have a lot of those components brewing. But at the same time, when you start to see that the world economic circumstance, minus a few characters and like the euro in Europe, and of course now the eruptions in the Middle East, and maybe even some inflationary pressures in China and India, et cetera. But, you know, when we start to see the calming forces of the world, and particularly the world economics, start to, well, you know, get a little bit better in line, I just question how good gold is going to be over the long haul. That doesn't mean that, you know, short term, over the next 1 month, 2 months, it may go up and down, and it may, you know, really, really spike up if we see significant activities and flare-ups throughout the world and the inflation measures picking up, et cetera, concern about the U.S. currencies, all that. But you have to wonder what the long-term game plan really is. You know, we saw gold also drop just like, well, most other investments and commodities when the dollar came up, when there was that flight to safety back in 2008 and 2009. So you really have to question the idea of how much can gold really protect you? Now, I'm not saying it shouldn't be in your portfolio. I'm not saying it's not a good investment. I'm not saying anything of that. I just think that you have to really be, you know, consider the fact that it is part of a portfolio, obviously not the whole portfolio. And we've been in and out of gold here. We have some commodity mutual funds that we invest in for our global allocations, for example. We have used GLD before. We moved in it, moved out of it. Right now, we're out of it. But at the same time, you have to, I think, look at all the other options you have available as well. Also, realize that the Middle East tensions, you know, spiked up most commodities last week, including oil, which was up about 4% on Friday. So that's something to consider. All right, so I wanted to talk about a few different things and focus on for a moment the whole issue that's happening in, well, throughout the Middle East and other countries. We talked about this and wrote about this and really focused on this in our latest quarterly commentary that we send out to our clients. One of the things we talked about was the inflationary pressures, particularly involved in food. We saw that the UN, United Nations, put out an update to their annual and ongoing food cost survey, and it was the highest that it ever was in history. We mentioned that on the DH Unplugged show recently. I think we even mentioned it here. Now, with that in mind, we talked about how there was going to be this gigantic separation between the haves and the have-nots. You know, the old days, there was the upper class, the middle class, the lower class, right? Well, the middle class has essentially disappeared. It's still there. There's still remnants of it. But we're really in a worldwide environment. It appears that it's like a haves and the have-nots. Don't you see it? You're going to see it in the news coming up, I'm telling you. Just keep an eye out for the new class of the world. There is clearly the emergence of a have and a have not. We see it in America. We see it with the jobless rate. We see it with the salary, kind of the salary ranges of jobs. We see it clearly in Asia. There's no question about that. With that, what happens is when we see that a situation like that happens here in the United States, where our Fed is trying to actually go out and purposefully increase inflation by flooding extraordinary amounts of money into the system through whether it's QE2, stimulus, whatever it is. And that has the net effect of pushing up commodity prices, not only in the United States, but all over the world. What do you think is going to happen? There is going to be situations like Egypt that is going to be affecting the rest of the world. You can't stop and contain inflation. Once that genie is out of the bottle, it's all over. The way that we're going at it here is affecting poverty-stricken nations all over the world. Those that have to pay the greatest per capita cost for their actual food are getting hurt. Wheat prices, rice, corn, cooking oils, is disproportionately a large part of the cost of their daily living. We've talked about it here before. We say, you know, you can actually get away with not driving your car. You can get away with a lot of things. You can get away with not showering. Eating is not one of those things that a human being can get away from. It's simple math. So what we're doing here has spread the disease of higher food costs around the world, clearly causing Egypt to revolt. Now, let's also set the record straight here for a minute. We know that for the last 30 years in Egypt, we have allowed for a dictatorship to go on because we want to keep the peace. We want things to, you know, as long as Egypt doesn't cause any problems, we'll give them $1.5 billion a year. We'll support whatever government they have. Just do me a favor. Keep a low profile, boys. That's kind of the message we've sent. That's not kind of the message we sent. That is the message that we sent, right? So when we see now that there is an uprising, what happened? Well, I can tell you from kind of a strange way, you know, in a way, Egypt, here's a lesson to be learned. You could take away somebody's liberty. You could take away somebody's money. You could torture them. You could take away some of their food. You could take away all sorts of things. Never turn off the internet, especially don't screw with somebody's Facebook or Twitter account. Now, this is going to all lead back to a big discussion in the upcoming weeks, I am certain, about President Obama having the kill switch on the internet. Just wait and see. But if you look at the internet traffic, what happened probably Wednesday or Thursday in Egypt, they shut down the internet for the most part throughout the country. Why? Because it was a breeding ground, as the government saw it, for revolution. It was a breeding ground for the ability for people to meet and plan a potential coup. Never did they realize that if they allowed the internet to continue, maybe people will stay in their houses and plan. Now what they've done is force people out on the streets. They have no other way to communicate, or very little ways to communicate. So what happened is they turn off the internet and they basically shut down all social networking, except for some things. They even shut down some satellites, which is interesting. And they revolted. And the people are saying, you know, no more. And I don't want to talk about all the politics of what's going on inside of there, because the fact is that they're replacing the government, but they're staying, you know, Mubarak is staying at the lead. That's just stupid. I mean, obviously, there is going to be the continuation of this upheaval and uproar. And I do fear one thing. The continuation of, I should say, the success of the government overthrow in Egypt, if it happens, and the blueprint that was laid in Tunisia, along with the poverty-stricken nations having such a problem with food payments and the cost of food, I think is going to actually lead to further protests and further defiant actions by citizens around the world against the governments who have really been oppressive and have not helped out. You know, the old let them eat cake governments around the world. There really is no question that this is going on. And I think we have to look at that now from an investment standpoint. You know, look at the markets throughout the weekend, and we saw Saudi Arabia drop. We saw 5 or 6%. We saw on during the week that Egypt dropped, I think, a total of 12% during the week. They closed their stock market on Sunday, which is open on Sunday. And, you know, we saw the U.S. stock market, the NASDAQ, tumble 2.5% on this news on Friday, the Dow tumble about 2%, et cetera, going on and on. The fact of the matter is, will this be a short-term blip like Dubai was? Remember when Dubai came out with the announcement that they were actually going to have to potentially, this months ago, default on their debt, and the markets went just into a tailspin, but just all of a sudden everybody said, not a big deal. You know, earnings are better here. Things are looking better in the United States. Not a big deal. And the world picked up and everything got better. Of course, we had some help from the government again of pushing things higher. But the question is, how far does this spread into the economics of the world as well as the financial markets of the world? With the consumption that they have in Egypt, with the ability of governments to oppress and for the potential for revolts, revolutions, and coups, you have to wonder where that's all going to lead. Now, I will tell you, on the other hand, it is clear also that we're seeing a better global economy, putting this aside for a second, clearly seeing a better global economics. That doesn't mean it's going to last, because don't forget that sometimes the best times are on the way up, not at the top, right? That's a lesson learned from 2007, 2008, I think very clearly for all of us. I think the reality is that we have to realize that the unemployment rate is not the telltale sign of anything other than the unemployment rate. It's not a predictor necessarily, and it is not even a lagging indicator that helps us with anything. The housing number is the same thing. The reality, I think, that we all have to learn and that we all did take a lesson of right now is that you don't fight the Fed for the most part. I think that's, you know, the reality that when governments come in with both hands and both feet pumping money into the system, creating stimulus at every corner, I think the reality is that you have to pay attention. All the other things are not as important because in a sense, if you think about it, the money that is poured in by the governments goes right to the companies or at least indirectly to the companies. And you're seeing tremendous amount of opportunity and profits. Look at Caterpillar, all-time high. They're seeing massive orders. You look at a variety of stocks. You know, would you have thought that a Priceline.com, who's traveling, right? You know, during this bad time, not recently, but in the, but no, nonetheless, there was a great opportunity there. Clearly, a better mousetrap they built for travel. No question about that. But at the same time, you have to realize that there are opportunities. Now, we look at some of the things that happened last week, and particularly towards the end of last week, and you have to start to wonder, did the economists, did the analysts get ahead of themselves? So let's kind of focus on that. Let's segue into what else happened last week and what may be shaping the weeks to come. The first thing was, or one of the things that happened was Microsoft. Microsoft came out with numbers. Now, here's two things happened last week that were very disturbing. I got to tell you. The first thing was that, actually, I'll go with three things. The first thing was that every time that the market started to dip and we watched one of the things that you could see and watch where markets are heading is called the tick. It's technically the up versus down shares, right? The up buy, the buys versus the sells. And you can kind of see the culmination of all that inside the tick. And there's different ticks you can look at, the New York Stock Exchange, the whole market. But when you saw the tick starting to come down past zero, meaning there's a lot more selling going on than buying, every single time in the beginning of the week, almost synchronously with it, was the movement of the euro. When the market was selling off, the euro would move higher, or said another way, the dollar would move lower. Now, I thought that was kind of strange. I asked some of my friends and some people in the business said, you know, what is with that? Why do you think we're seeing this? Is there a gigantic carry trade going on right now? Possibly. But it was nonstop for a couple of days. Then, I believe it was Tuesday or Wednesday, the market started coming down. And lo and behold, towards the middle of the day, there was this gigantic trade in IBM that pushed IBM up about 4 points. Now, remember something. IBM is a gigantic part of the Dow, right? So think about this. When IBM moves, the Dow will move. It's not the only thing, but it's a big part of the Dow. So if IBM moves up four points out of nowhere, the Dow moves up. Now, follow me here. There's a fat finger trade that we find out that spikes IBM, which of course spikes the Dow, which then has the shorts covering. As the shorts cover, it pushes things up. And as the things pushes things up, lo and behold, the shorts cover. Brilliant move. All right, let's go to the next one. The next thing that happens was on Thursday. On Thursday, the market started coming down, and they looked like they ended flat, and there was a kind of a bump in the road on Thursday. And lo and behold, miraculous happening of, you guessed it, Microsoft. Microsoft has their quarterly numbers, their report on earnings, leaked 15 minutes before the closing bell. Traditionally, obviously, Microsoft comes out after the bell. There could be even a trading halt to the stock as they disseminate information, but they come out with a top-line beat, and that's all the news we see immediately. At that instant, the market turns upward. Again, Microsoft in the Dow, by the way. The market turns up. Microsoft is up about 2.5% on that news. There's a lot of checking going on. What is it? Is it real? Is it not? Is it a real release? Is it a fake release? How is it out there? And the market moves up, and yes, the market moves up. Shorts have to cover or desire to cover. They don't want to be in the Microsoft position into the close because they think there's a better earnings number, and yada, yada, yada. That helps the Dow move higher, etc. Now, once it is found out and the final information is leaked, of course, we did see that Microsoft, before the close on Thursday, came back down all the gains that it made. Overnight, as the news was disseminated, as the conference call went on, there was a little bit of a sell-off in Microsoft. Then reality hit on Friday, realizing that there was really a really a poor outlook when it came to PC sales, and in particular also a little bit of a disappointment in some of their, I think it was the Windows sales. The revenue was a bit of a shortfall when it came to that. Clearly, Kinect was looking good. A variety of other areas was looking good. And to be honest with you, the truth of the matter is the numbers did not look that bad. The numbers really didn't look bad. But you know what? Microsoft gets no respect from investors. Let's face it. Look at the chart over, on a monthly basis even, over 2, 3, 4, 5 years. Look at the chart over a longer period of time. Look at a weekly chart of Microsoft. Yes, it popped in the market, et cetera. It gets no respect during earnings. Look at all the earnings dates of the past. You'll see that it really gets no respect on earnings. And then there's potential and hope and then opportunity, and then it rides up a bit, and then it gets usually flatlined to nowhere right after earnings. Now, in addition to Microsoft, we'll talk about some of the other things that happened that shaped Friday's markets aside from the whole situation in the Middle East. But we also saw that Ford came out with earnings. Now, did you see that? It flashed across my screen and I saw it and I said, nah, that's not right. That can't be right. We don't own Ford, but that number seems not comparable. A lot of times earnings will come out and they're not comparable, right? You know, you see that maybe there was some adjustment, a one time, maybe it was some kind of change of accounting, a different, who knows what it is. Well, Ford comes out with numbers, and I got to tell you something, they looked atrocious. Yes, their sales were good, but you know what? Their EPS fell really short. And when we got into looking at why that was, did you see what it was? It was the input costs. Hello? No inflation, of course, but input costs have been skyrocketing, killing their margins, on top of the fact that their sales in Europe pretty much fell off a cliff. So even though they had good sales overall, their margins were squeezed, something we've been talking about a lot about what to look for in the next quarters to come. Their margins were being squeezed and their net earnings were hurt by the input costs. Now, does anybody out there have any disagreement with me or any thought other than the fact that we're going to see margins compress? That doesn't mean it's a terrible thing. We're not talking crash. We're not yet. We're not talking about any of that. We're just talking about the fact that when we look at what is going on with the cost of all raw materials, it seems pretty obvious that when you are manufacturing something, anything, that your costs are going to go up. Now, you may be able to offset them somehow with maybe more cuts in labor. Maybe you could offset them with further technology enhancements or maybe a little bit of re-engineering here or there, whatever you want to do. But the fact of the matter is you can't help but agree with the fact that input costs are going up. Even Amazon came out with numbers and said that their input costs went up. And their own input costs are much different than Ford. They're not really manufacturing, right? They're just reselling or selling and retailing. But the cost to build a lot of the facilities that they're building went up. And they fell short. Amazon was down 8%. Ford was down like 12%. I think Microsoft down 3 or 4%. It was an ugly day. Now, on top of that, we got two things. We got the GDP number. The print came in at 3.2. A lot of people were thinking 3.5, 3.7. And there was a lot of optimism, just like there was a lot of optimism going into Ford, Microsoft, and Amazon's numbers. And the interesting thing about the GDP, when you looked at the inflation component of it, it's not there. Now, I know I just said all the input costs are going up, and we have to watch that moving forward, but there is no real inflation, as long as you look at it according to the government statistics, of course. But everybody out there, I defy you to answer this question. Has your costs gone up for things? Well, of course. For the most part. Not everything, but for the most part. Man, gas is up, food is up, right? Clothes are up. What else do you have? You know, electronic costs are, you know, maybe TVs are down, you know, the flat panels. Maybe those prices are down. But when you look at overall, the costs are going up. So when we look at this and combine that with one more piece, which was the Michigan final sentiment index, consumer sentiment index that we saw on Friday, we saw that really wasn't a really great number. It actually dipped from last month, even though it was still a very solid number. But the current indications were that things weren't so good right now. That's the one component out of the three of current and the more important one that we look at is the outlook. You know, what is the outlook? That stayed steady, but the current situation dropped down. Now, you have to say to yourself, well, what's doing that? Well, is it the continuation of the jobs numbers being a concern? You know, we're seeing that 9.4%, we talked about this, last month's numbers were skewed. Next Friday comes out the actual numbers again. It's around the corner again. Can you believe that? We're going to see the jobs numbers again. And I would wager that we're going to see an increase in the rate, probably 9.5%, 9.6%, clearly moving back up. There was an aberration in the last number. But at 140 print or 160 or 120 print max on next week's number, that's no way making a dent in the unemployment situation. So therefore, we go back again, just keep on turning back around and chasing our tail that the government's going to come in with more stimulus and the Fed's going to come in with more money and there'll be the continuation, if not the addition, to the $600 billion QE2 and blah-de-de-blah-de-de-blah. So the story is kind of the same when it comes to all of this. We have an economy that's strengthening for the most part. Inventories have been, inventories levels have been coming down, but yet the inventory to sales ratio has been going up. So when you start reading about inventories, always put those in the perspective of the inventory to sales ratio. You want to see how much is being inventoried, but how much is being sold. Because you can't tell just by one number or the other what's happening with inventories. You need to see how fast the inventories are being depleted according to a comparison of sales. If inventories are being pushed down, yet there are no sales, that just may mean that there's not a lot of production because there's not a lot of orders. So while you may see a depleting inventory number, well, that looks good, but realize that that's not a great thing because there may not be a replenishment of that inventory is what you need to keep the cycle going. On the other hand, if you see a good number, if you see a lot of sales, but you really no changes in the inventory, you realize that probably there's going to be a good thing in the future that there's going to be additional drawdown on inventory because of sales, and then you're going to have more inventory restocking. Anyway, some economics to look at, some things to consider, and realize that there's a lot of changing dynamics right now when it comes to the housing market that really isn't going anywhere. The Case-Shiller was out, down 1%. New home sales were up a bit, breaking ground a little bit. Pending home sales looked okay, and it's still in the face of this high unemployment rate and all that. So putting this all together, what we kind of amassed last week, good numbers from some companies like some of the cloud computer companies actually did very well. And in the face of a concern of, don't forget about what happened of F5, this kind of a replay of what happened last quarter. A couple of companies stunk it up. Everything dropped like crazy. Then everybody came back showing good numbers and it went straight up. Coal did amazing. We saw some great things. Massey Energy being bought by Alpha Natural. We also saw oil really tick up dramatically. We saw Netflix have a great number, right? And at the end of the day, it just takes a little bit to shake out the over bullishness that we're seeing in this market. Now, on the DH Unplugged, we talked about the DeMarc indicators. Tom DeMarc has a technical analysis setup that he uses. Very intricate, very interesting. We've talked about it here before. Well, I guess the way you can look at it is, considering where exhaustion points are in the market. So you could even say oversold, overbought, but he uses exhaustion. You know, where is it there's a point of exhaustion in the selling and exhaustion in the buying? Where is it that the buying shows that this continuation of, let's call it breadth and opportunity on the upside, but where does it finally become a point that's like too much? You know, in a way you say, well, the market's been up 10 days in a row. Well, that's a lot. Well, he uses this and he's done this mathematically looking a couple days back, compared to today, for certain indicators, one day back, it has to be at least lower than or above than, et cetera, et cetera. Over a period, he uses like 9 days in sequence or 13 days. And he recently came out about a week and a half ago with a note that the markets, general equity market, should have a 10% correction within about a week or so. Now, that was about a week and a half ago. So, obviously, looking at his time frame, he was incorrect, right? So you look at the time frame and say, well, it didn't have a correction, nor did it even look like it was going into correction at that time. And as a matter of fact, I think it went up a bit. But now I will tell you that if you really look at his data, he's pretty timely with the fact that the markets are starting to sag here a bit. Now, whether they pick up right now or not, again, we'll compare it again. We'll look at what he says. But there's a guy that I really encourage you to check out, Tom DeMarc. There's a few books on the DeMarc indicators. You know, we've had Kevin DePew on before, and he uses them, not exclusively, but to a great degree to to find opportunity on a long-term or a short-term basis. You know, sometimes he looks over months and months and months to see what the trend is and find out when the exhaustion points are on a monthly basis. So you may have an opportunity that you're watching, and then the entry may be, you know, 4, 5, 6 months out. That requires a lot of patience. Also, I mean, you could do it on a weekly or daily basis, but I really encourage you, if you have the opportunity to read up on DeMarc indicators, and if you use technical analysis at all, this is something that you could possibly import into your system. I think TradeStation has some DeMarc indicators that you can use, and a few other of the high-end technical indicator programs have DeMarc indicators that are pre-programmed. You could probably do some programming of your own or buy a separate package as well to use them, but really, really neat stuff. Now, I want to switch back to kind of bouncing around a little bit here today, but I want to switch back to the discussion of Egypt that I have in my notes, because I wanted you to go grab something. On Sundays, we usually post something called Sunday Fun on the Disciplined Investor. And that talks about maybe some interesting things. We put up a video a couple weeks back by this English comedy duo. It was called My Blackberry is Frozen. If you haven't had an opportunity to watch it, it's hysterical, okay? I won't tell you anymore because I really want you to watch it. So just go to check out Sunday Fun on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We put up some other videos that were kind of funny that we see. We put up a variety of different things there. Business related, but yet not so serious. Well, this week what I did was I went to search out where I can find news and information on Egypt that is either streaming, or I can get it in an RSS feed, or I can get it as a mashup or something, anything that I can get instantaneous downloads of information. And I put that each clickable link on a Sunday Fun post. So for example, it's kind of cool. You can actually watch live tweets on a map as they appear throughout Egypt. That's one of them. Another one is that you can watch, for example, a mashup of every news item, tweet, Facebook comment, all that on Google Real Time. And I coded it in there so you can actually go and grab it, just click on it. And then if you want to save it as a bookmark, or save the page as a bookmark for that matter, then you can go back and utilize all these different features. You know, give me only CNN that talks about Egypt. Give me the latest from Haaretz, the newspaper out of Israel. Give me the latest information on YouTube videos that give me the, on the Egypt conflict. A variety of these kind of things that you can actually go and get real-time information from both news sources and individuals that are either on the scene talking about it or have some information. And you know what? You don't have to use all of them. You may not like all the different things. You may not, hey, I don't really like using Twitter for that. I really like using core news sources. Some people may say, screw the news source. I don't like that. I want to go right to videos so I can see what's going on. Anyway, that's all available. Go check it out. I'll put a link in the show notes as well, so you can have that. But I think that's a really neat way to track the news. Now, what you could do with this, let me give you a hint. What you could do with this also is when you go to the various links that I give you, you could change the search criteria on some of them to equal something that you would want to see. For example, let's say that you wanted to find, let me think of something here. Let's say that you wanted to find instantaneous information, anybody talking about your favorite car. Let's say it's a Corvette. So what you could do instead of using Egypt conflict, Egypt uprising, you would put maybe the word Corvette or maybe something Corvette engine. I don't know, something of that nature if you want to get specific. And you would get the same kind of updates. You can see how it's coded. You can see how the searches are run. And then you could save the links yourself so that you can actually create your own actual mashup or feeds for the things that you want to see. And then a lot of these you could use into RSS feeds. So if you use Google Reader or some other RSS reader, you could actually get that and culminate that. Kind of a little bit what like Google Real Time tries to do. The other thing that's out there is we put the Google Trends and the Google information about the internet bandwidth use, how much is going on in Egypt, and it's obviously dropped down to pretty much zero. I tried to get the official Egyptian government and the government's page and their reactions or comments, but since the internet's down there, you can't get on, so I didn't bother putting that on. And they'll be up eventually, I guess, but right now they're not, so there's no information there. There's no information available at all. So Anyway, that's what's going on there. Let's talk about next week what's going on. We have Baidu coming out. Lots of earnings, more economics coming out. I believe that the few days that if the continuation of Egypt and God forbid there's any more things that happen throughout the world, you know, horrible things, is going to be a continuation of a sell-off in the markets. So, you know, this is one of those times you have to look at, you know, how do you protect yourself? Do you use options? Do you use ETFs? The VIX option, the VIX index went up 24% on Friday. Dramatic move for not that big of a sell-off on the markets, which obviously is telling you there's a lot more fear out there. So you could use options. The VIX is an interesting one to utilize if you want to buy some VIX calls. You could actually go out and do something different. If you think the economy is still good and this is just a, you know, short-term potential problem, you know what else you could do? You can actually sell some puts. Now, let me explain that for a second. Usually you want to buy puts, right? You want to buy puts on an index because if the index goes down, you'll want to profit from that. But what I said to you, let's hear it again. What I said to you is if you think things are good, if you think the stock is just getting hit because of a temporary setback, if that's the case, you would want to sell a put. Let's get into that. So let's say, let's use Microsoft as just an example. Let's assume, and let's put the earnings out of the, off the table for a second, just again, use an everyday, you know, Microsoft situation. You like Microsoft, you don't own it yet, you want to buy it. But, you know, you don't want to buy it because you think it may go down and you want to buy it at a lower price, but it may go up. One of the things you could do is actually sell a put at, let's say, 25, taking a couple of bucks or whatever the premium may be. And if Microsoft goes down below 25, you are obligated to buy it. So again, just using a very simple and not real example, if Microsoft is trading at 27 and it goes to 25, you get $2 on it. You get to buy it at 25. You're really buying at 23, right? You get a $2 premium on the option plus the fact that $25 is what you have to pay. So you subtract that and you really pay 23. So you're really, what you're doing here is giving yourself the opportunity to buy Microsoft at a lower price. Now, what happens if Microsoft never gets down below 25? It stays exactly where it is until your option expires. Well, you get your $2 and have a nice day. So what I'm saying is that if you like certain stocks and you think they may go down and you're willing to play this game that if they go down, I'll buy them. In the meantime, I'll collect some money. You could sell some puts. But realize you'll be obligated to buy the stock. But there's a great play in a market, particularly that has a VIX that's rising, where premiums are rising on the puts, that you can go out and maybe find some stocks that you'd want to buy at a lower price. And again, there's a little bit more of a, I don't want to say gambling, but speculation involved in using options clearly. And you know, you have to know what you're doing here. It's not all the time, not every stock, not every circumstance, but an interesting way to collect some premium, be in the game on some of these, and give yourself an opportunity if the stock goes down. Now, let's kind of talk about the really bad things that can happen. So Microsoft goes down to 20. You're obligated to buy it at 25. You got $2, so it's really 23. But you know what? You just lost $3 on the deal. And you say, well, I could have sold it beforehand. Well, I'm saying if it just gets slammed down before you can actually get in and do the selling or the buying and the option spin. So realize that there is that situation that you can actually lose more money. But if you're willing to buy the stock at a lower price and hold it for a while, possibly entry through short puts is an interesting way for you to take a look at. Look it up. Look at shorting stocks, shorting options, going short puts of stocks for entry, something like that on the web, and learn a bit more about that. You could obviously, our friend over at Options Monster, John Najarian, has some good information probably on this. I'm certain of that. And you can see what they say about that and figure out if this is something that you know you want to pursue. And if it's something that you think that is worthwhile for you. But I thought that was an option play you could do. The second thing you could do here, aside from playing the short side, temporary side, is obviously to look at the potential for shorting, you know, shorting against your portfolio. Now, one of the things that has happened over the last few months is that that shorting against a basket or an index has not really worked very well. And what I mean by that is, if you were to short, let's say, the S&P 500 through an ETF, let's say, and you're long stock, you know, what's happened is if you weren't really properly allocated, your shorts hurt you and your longs hurt you, or the shorts didn't really help you, the hedges didn't help you, and the longs didn't help you at all and hurt you even more during the downturns. Now, why is that? Well, you had financials that turned around. If you didn't have financials in your portfolio, well, that wasn't good, right? Okay. You had some technology, but you know, the utilities and a few others, you know, lagged and not too badly. Nothing was really being sold off. It wasn't a whole baby out with the bathwater concept. So the index hedging didn't work. You had to get more specific. So for example, we just added last week, actually, fortunately, early last week, we added a small cap hedge to our portfolio because our portfolio was leaning on technology and more of a small cap bias. I wouldn't say small caps, but at least the way small caps traded. So what we did is we added a hedge into the small cap area utilizing an inverse Russell 2000 ETF. Now, we did that because we saw that markets were getting a little bit toppy. Okay. Individual stocks had, we thought, some good room still because of earnings that were coming out and analyst upgrades. Okay, great. Charts looked good. They were in an uptrend. All the good things. But at the same time, the Russell 2000 had been weak throughout 2011. Now, oftentimes, you want to see the Russell really doing well in January because you have that small cap January effect that usually goes into play. That did not. Probably the weakest index of the large, mid, and small cap. Clearly, the small cap index has been the weakest this year. So we saw that as a sign that if it broke through first 777, which our first support point of the Russell 2000, and then if it eventually broke down below 772, which is still above, that would be a much greater sign and a signal. If it could break down and stay below, at least for a day, let's say, below 772 on the Russell 2000, that we would add significantly to that short position. So right now we have about, I would say 60% of our position in that short. And that helped us out on Friday very well, actually. Helped us out last week very well. So these are the kind of things that you need to think about. You know, is this going to be a long-term situation that is going to be a big sell-off? Obviously, you got to take your loss on a stock if it starts moving against you. And you have to be willing to sit on the sideline or to get a little bit short. This market has been a market, though, of buy on the dips. We have to see if that continues. And until it fails, you have to believe that it is, right? Until it fails, you have to believe that there is going to be buyers stepping in from somewhere. Whether it's going to be through a carry trade, whether it's going to be because of earnings, whether it's going to be because of economic expansion, people finally saying, okay, I want to be in, whether it's the mutual fund managers or hedge funds that are pushing, whatever it is. Right now, the continuation is the buy on the dip mentality. And until that fails, we have to assume that it's going to be continuing. You may not believe that. It doesn't matter whether I believe that either. Whether I believe that the market's rolling over, until it proves itself, right, we have to kind of stick with it. That's the game plan right now. So yeah, it's a time to kind of thin out the portfolio a little bit, those stocks that aren't working, things that are working against you and that, you know, you've been kind of struggling with that may fall out, not the leaders that you've had. You need to start thinking about, okay, where do I go? Do I go to healthcare? We like a company like a Medco Health. We like Perrigo. We love Perrigo. It's one of our biggest positions in our portfolio, as a matter of fact. There's some technology we like. We talked to you about Glu Mobile, kind of crazy stock in last week. I think it was up like, I don't know, 30 or 40% last week. It was crazy. It's a small stock, thin float, obviously aggressive. Be very careful with this. Why do we have it? Well, they make some great games and apps for the iPhone and other devices. Tremendous World Series of Poker app. Tremendous. Just teamed up with Facebook. And on the heels of on the potential heels of a Zynga, which makes Farmville, Mafia Wars, and a couple of poker games, and Scramble, et cetera. If they go public, there's going to be, we think at least, a real appreciation and a real notice of some of these stocks that are in that same genre. The opportunity they have from a design and execution standpoint, distribution and marketing is amazing. So you look at that, you look at you know, all these different plays that made the news last week, clearly. You know, the big guys coming down and the rotation into banks and that fell off after Citi's and Bank of America's earnings, you know, Goldman just getting crushed and oil stocks moving up higher, coal running higher due to the cost of coal, et cetera, food prices moving higher and the food stocks doing well. And then you have a lot of the things that are working, but a lot of the rotation that's going on. Just be aware there is a rotation going on right now. There is going to be, again, if there is a continuation into next week of the situation in Egypt, there is a possible risk trade off that's going to go on. And you'll see a lot of the winners that have really ran up in the last year continue to see money being taken out of them because of their substantial inclusion in a lot of portfolio managers' portfolios, that they just want to take some of the profits out and hold it till there's a better time and then push it right back in. So just be aware of that. With that, we're going to, I think we'll end the show today. I think there was a couple things I want to mention on the close here. Ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I want you to write me what question you may have coming up for episode number 200, the call-in show. So write me and give me your phone number and a quick topic of what you want to talk about. We'll set it up. I want everybody to participate. Seriously. Listen, I want everybody to participate. That's too many. We can't really do that. But I really want a good amount of call-ins and get as many as we can in there. Of course, the winning investor is available at Barnes & Noble throughout the country or Borders or Amazon, wherever you want to get it. It's the quick and dirty tips guide to making money in any market. And I encourage you to check that book out, available on Kindle or iBook, all that good stuff as well. Of course, the Disciplined Investor is still available on Amazon, also on audible.com. Great stuff there. And I encourage you to check out some of that information. And of course, come to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We blog all sorts of stuff and tell you about the stocks that we're looking at and a variety of economic indicators and the outlook and some fun things that we talked about as well. Listen, make sure to tell a friend about this show. Leave a comment on iTunes if you enjoy the show. If you don't, definitely don't leave a comment. I'm kidding. No, if you don't enjoy the show, leave a comment too. We'll try to figure out what we're doing wrong, figure out what to do right. Leave a comment over at iTunes. I really appreciate that. Not just a rating, but a comment too on iTunes, and we'll see what's happening. Tell a friend. Do that little ping thing that they do. Tell a friend about the Disciplined Investor podcast, and hopefully you're going to have a good and successful week. This is Andrew Horowitz thanking you for joining me today on episode number 197. We'll see you next week with some great guests, some great opportunity to talk about stocks, markets, economy, and whatever else is on your mind. I'll see you soon. Thanks for joining me. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.